This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 87.
I remember when I was offered the role at Digital Bridge, we were debating around CHRO, Chief People Officer. I said, well, I would love the P to be about performance, not people, because at the end of the day, HR needs to be in charge and accountable of anything that leads to improve the performance of organization, right? So anything that you can do to make the boat go faster, that's the role we have, right? Because everybody else already has a job. The CMO has a job, the COO has a job. We have this job that is about making the boat go faster from an organizational perspective. So for me, that's the biggest opportunity, and I think organizations need that more than ever.
Why should you treat your employees like you treat your customers? Why should chief people officers think of themselves as chief performance officers? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Hey everyone, if you've been listening to the podcast, then you know I'm incredibly passionate about inspiring and developing the next generation of HR leaders. But you may not know, I'm also passionate about speaking to and working with HR organizations to enhance their capabilities. In fact, one of the coolest things that happened since I've launched the podcast is that several HR organizations have asked me to speak about the future of HR and to support their efforts to develop their HR teams. It's been an incredible honor to work with these HR organizations in 2023, and I'm looking to have an even bigger impact in 2024. If you'd like me to speak to your HR organization, or if I can ever be helpful in building the capability of your HR team, please reach out, as I would love to hear from you. My guest this week is Francisco Sorrentino. Francisco is the Chief People Officer at Digital Bridge, which is a fast-growing global investment firm that owns, operates, and invests across the full spectrum of digital infrastructure. In this role, Francisco is responsible for managing Digital Bridge's organizational effectiveness, team engagement, and performance and employee value proposition. And prior to joining Digital Bridge in 2023, Francisco was the Chief Human Resources Officer and operating partner at SoftBank Group, where he built the internal HR function and a human capital practice to support SoftBank's portfolio companies. Prior to the SoftBank Group, Francisco led the Human Resources Division for Microsoft in Latin America. And prior to Microsoft, Francisco led the Organizational Effectiveness Practice at AIG during the reorganization post the 2008 financial crisis. He also held various leadership positions at IBM over his 17 years with the company. Francisco is a humble, innovative, and results-driven chief people officer, and I know you're going to get a lot out of our conversation today. As we discuss why you should treat your employees like you treat your customers, why working in early-stage startups can drive exponential development and professional growth, especially early in your career, what he's learned from working with early stage company founders and CEOs, and how he assesses talent and determines if someone's a fit for the role or the organization, and much, much more. Francisco, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
Thank you, JP. Thank you for the invite. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you on the podcast and not only hear about your amazing career, but you've got a really, I think, a great vantage point on talent that I want to talk a little more about as well. And so just excited to have you on the podcast. I know you're from Argentina, so we want to say congratulations to you in the World Cup. I have to bring that up. For all my friends in Argentina, I always want to say that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
You started your career at IBM in Argentina as a compensation and benefits manager, but you quickly moved up to different HR roles. And then after about 8 years with IBM in Argentina, you actually moved to the United States to support marketing and communications from an HR perspective. And you've said that kind of moving from Argentina to the U.S. was a pivotal moment in your career because you really experienced a clash of cultures. Tell us more about that experience and why did you experience a clash of cultures and what was that like as an HR professional?
Yeah. So first, I will note that I started my career with IBM actually in finance. So my move from finance to HR was my first clash of cultures, I would say. That was a big one. And then, yes, when I moved from Argentina to the US, which I have to say, my landing port was Miami. I stayed in Miami for about 18 months, and then I transitioned to New York. I would say I even had a soft landing, right? Because I would say Miami is very blended with Latin America culture. It's a big clash because I don't know how much you know about Latin America, but Argentina, not to generalize, is a very unstructured place from a rules perspective. I think culturally people are naturally nimble as a product of crisis after crisis and lots of poverty, lots of people hustling and trying to find their living. And it's not an easy place to live. And again, it makes you a hustler. Also, it's a country that doesn't have obviously the scale of a country like US. So you have a lot of people that do a lot of things. Specialization is not that prevalent in a country like Argentina. So when you go into the US, you have a country that is very mature from a rules perspective. There is an appreciation for life and norms and respect that perhaps is not so prevalent in a country like Argentina. It's a country where there is a high level of respect and appreciation for specialization. So going deep, being data-based, opinions are not so relevant. So I would say I went from cold to warm or warm to cold. I'm glad I didn't break, right? Any material exposed to sudden change in temperature does. So it was a very, very demanding and very challenging from that perspective. It forced me to think about the way I live, really, not just the way I work, the way I think in a way as well. So, and very interesting because I would say both built a very complementary character in me, right? I never abandoned my Argentinian heritage. Nobody really can do that. But I really embrace the values and the norms and the positive things that the US has to offer that are plenty and complement what I had. So it was great.
Well, it's so great about that response and just hearing more about how nimble maybe growing up in Argentina has made you is that, you know, as HR professionals, you have to grow and change throughout your career. You're never stagnant. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm going to fire my research partner here, which is myself, of course, that didn't know you were a finance manager. And we can go back to that a little bit. So in going from finance to comp and bin or HR, what made you decide to leave finance and then go into HR, even if it was maybe a more quantitative side of HR? I'm curious about that.
You will not expect this answer. The short answer is the coolness factor. And nobody would put HR and coolness together maybe nowadays. But back then I was in finance and I was approached by the compensation department because they thought I had the right blend between being a numbers and a people person. The funny thing is the compensation department, because of all the data that was handled and the secrecy around comp, and at IBM, it was a very stellar function. It was almost like joining the FBI. It was a very intriguing area with very capable people. It was an honor for me to be considered to join that group. It was very small. It was all about research. Back then, we were gathering all the data by hand. We were going to go company by company, gathering all the data, doing the analysis ourselves. So it was very mathematical. It was very, a lot of statistics. I love numbers. So for me, it was a bit of a very interesting blend. And once I started, I actually never hesitated and keep doing it. So it was a one-way ticket.
I love it. So HR was cool, which makes sense. I think you're right. IBM had has a great HR function. It's known for that. But it probably did feel different to go do more special projects that weren't the typical numbers and spreadsheets you might be doing in finance, right? A little bit more different in different projects.
It was way cooler, I would say. It felt a lot more less siloed. You would be spending a lot of time in the outside world, right? Talking to other companies, talking to very smart colleagues, you would learn a lot from other people, particularly if you were just starting your career. There was a lot of really experienced people out there on the consulting firms and also on the large firms in Argentina, the international firms like Exxon, McDonald's, you name it, any industry, from the tech industry as well. But it was very, very enlightening and very eye-opening for me.
And then at some point you decided to actually leave IBM, which is a pivotal moment in your career because it's hard to leave IBM. You've done so much work there and have built up such a great reputation. But what made you decide to move on to a new role and take on a new challenge?
First, I think is in my mind, in retrospective, I think it was super hard. But when I did it, it didn't feel like that hard. It felt like a bit obvious. But I always had a very deep sense of appreciation for IBM because they gave me an opportunity, and actually they gave me opportunity after opportunity. And it's true. I mean, you take them, you make the most out of them, but the company was incredibly good at seeking for ways to develop people and getting the best out of you. There was exceptional people there. And I think people like Randy McDonald was my mentor, my CHRO at one point, but there's many people I could name. And it was interesting because I felt like I was home. And I guess it's when you're 18 years old and you're about to go to college, almost like you want to end a phase of your life and then start a new one. And for me, IBM was that, a great phase in my life. It was home. It was my university of, let's say, on the professional side. I had a lot of recipes, had a lot of theory in my, let's say, backpack. And I felt like I really wanted to test a lot of this, right? And I wanted to really reveal a little bit against the protocols at IBM and the way IBM had an incrementalism that companies like IBM are forced to have, right? Because the stakeholders want predictability and reliability. They don't want crazy things. They don't want adventure. They don't want testings. They want meet my expectations, right? Surprise me in a good way. And that leads to a culture and that leads to a feeling a bit tight when you are avid for trying to know what you're made of, right? It's not the place to give you that experience. So you need to find the right place to do it. And I guess I found it at AIG. It was a truly remarkable change going from everything resolved, company going on the track, going to a company that was completely off track.
Well, it's great to have those experiences in your career because it makes you a better athlete. It makes you a better HR professional, understanding what it's like to come from steady state to maybe turnaround to transformation. I encourage people to think about that, but be thoughtful. And you obviously were. You had a really good career at IBM. And then most recently, Francisco, you were the CHRO for SoftBank Group International, which invests in disruptive companies like SoFi, Alibaba. And about a year ago, you became the CHRO at DigitalBridge, which is a global alternative asset manager dedicated to investing in digital infrastructure. So these are very cool, interesting companies where talent really matters. But talk about how these experiences have impacted how you think about HR and how we deliver value.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a little bit connected to what I was describing when I decided to leave IBM, because I was at IBM, AIG, Microsoft. So I think these are all amazing companies in a way. And the environment they have, the stakeholders, the shareholders, the regulation, everything that surrounds these companies define how your life is going to be in the company, right? And what type of adventures you're going to live or not. And also it feels a bit that everything that you do has very little margin for real error and real risk. And you feel that your life is like you're going in a car, which is maybe a very, very fast car, but you're wearing 3 seatbelts and there's 17 airbags around you. And even if you really crash, nothing is really going to happen to you. You know what I mean? When you go to these companies, you feel like you are riding a motorcycle without a helmet, right? So you go from very cushioned, very protected, very safe decision-making to a decision-making that relies on your decisions and your ability to make them really fast out of the resources that you have with very little consultation and different parameters that usually exist in this company. So it's almost like playing hide and seek in the desert. There's really is you facing your challenge with the tools that you have at your disposal. And it's your decision and nobody else. You cannot blame it on anybody. You cannot share your accountability with anybody. It's you and you. Now, it sounds maybe scary or a bit lonely, but actually it's very exciting. And I feel like once you transition from playing that safe game to this a bit more like vigorous, more risky game, it's hard to go back. I'm not saying I wouldn't, but I would say that it's very little places in organizations that are very large where you really feel the excitement of making your own decisions.
Hey everyone, after a quick break, Francisco and I will be back to discuss why he believes you should treat your employees like your customers, why each of us needs to understand our zip code of value, and what he's learned from working with early stage company founders and CEOs. The Institute for the Future recently came out with a report that said 85% of jobs that will exist in 2030 haven't been invented yet. While I can't predict the future, I am certain that the only way to future-proof your career is by learning to learn. This applies to our organizations as well, and as HR leaders, our job is to ensure our team members have the skills and capabilities needed now and in the future. This is why I'm excited to announce the Future of HR podcast is now sponsored by Biz Library. Biz Library is the place where learning happens. They're your one-stop shop for all of your compliance, upskilling needs, and leadership development challenges. Biz Library is an industry leader for high-quality, off-the-shelf content that will solve your compliance needs, support the upskilling of teams, and will help your leaders to lead. If you're looking to elevate learning in your organization, give BizLibrary a call as they can support you with their innovative L&D platforms, best-in-class content, and unrivaled strategic support. And if you mention that JP at the Future of HR podcast sent you, you'll receive a 10% discount on year one of your BizLibrary contract. So head on over to bizlibrary.com and see how they can help you to elevate learning in your organization today. We're going to talk more about how you believe talent really creates value and how you think about assessing talent. But you're also a big believer in employee experience and thinking about employees as customers. And you said that organizations and leaders need to start thinking about their team members as customers, not employees. Tell us more about why you believe this is important and how you put this in practice.
So I grew up in a corporate environment where companies were the stars of a labor market, right? So when I remember in Argentina at IBM, I would drive by or walk by the building and say, I want to work there one day. Coincidentally, I ended up working there. But it was aspirational for me. And when they called me to do this trainee program, I was like feeling so excited that I was feeling I would do anything to get this opportunity. And I really worked super hard. And I worked weekends. I worked during the night. I did whatever it took to be successful in that environment. And I felt like it didn't matter how hard I was working. I owed them the possibility to gain another day, to survive for another day. So I had this deep sense of appreciation for what they were offering me. And I always felt that way. And to this day, I feel that I'm in debt to the organization that is employing me. And I feel like it's a very unnatural feeling, if you think about it. And new generations grow increasingly more independent, increasingly more confident with different background and different definition of what is work and what is the role that work plays in their lives. And they have choices. They are born. When I grew up, I don't want to talk too much about it because it's going to tell on my age, but I think I had 6 channels in my TV to watch. Now think about it. And then I think I had 1 brand of bubblegum, and I feel like it was 2 brands of milk, and there wasn't oat milk or almond milk. It was just milk, right? So now think about 20, 30, 40 years forward, everything is exponentially more available and the options are endless. And that also links to people to think in a very different way. So you're always exploring your optionality. When you reserve a hotel, when you buy blue jeans, when you buy your soda, when you pick what's the fast food place, and also when you think of your employment. So if you don't think of your employees as consumers, you are thinking in the wrong way, or at least you're not seeing the entire equation, which is what makes people to come back. And you will lose a lot of really important data about the sentiment of these people connected to the organization. It's really less about what HR does or doesn't do. It's more about what's the relationship that exists today between employees and employers and what it was many, many years ago when all these theories about management were developed. So for me, it doesn't matter what's your dominant position in the market, whether you can choose who you employ. For instance, I read an article where Citadel was actually receiving about 60,000 applications for, I think, something like 20 internship positions. So imagine what you can do with that power. You can basically go extreme. Your job is going to be 24/7. I'm not going to pay you, and people will still apply, right? But the key is not to abuse that opportunity and make it the other way around. Is when you're in a position of power, when you're in a position of health from an organizational perspective, you need to offer your best version and you offer your best treatment. It's not the moment to negotiate and be shortchange people. It's to say, I want to treat you the best way I can. And people should say that, yeah, that's true. You're not leaving money on the table. You're not trying to shortchange me, and you're giving me to the best of the abilities you have, thinking of your P&L, thinking about the company performance, thinking about the reality of the business. You're giving me the best you can. So that's, I think, what we do with our partners in life. Our friends, we should use that principle everywhere, no? In any risk. I remember IBM's, one of the principles was trust and responsibility in every relationship. It was one of the principles. And I always thought it was one of the most forming principles that I've had in my corporate life. And I tried to apply it. And I think that it was also foundational for this concept, no? So I don't know if it makes sense. But for me, this is the concept of how I think about employee experience. I always assume I can do better for you. For instance, we just launched a new performance management process, and everybody came to me and said, this was exponentially better than last time. But I know last time was horrible. So for me, the bar was so low that for me, that is not the definition of success. The definition of success is not a few leaders showing up and telling me. That felt great. It's for me, employees to reach out and say, the sense of transparency and fairness is improving thanks to this process. That's the real experience. Not the leader saying it was easy. I could be hands off. You made my life better. No, I don't care about that much. I care about the employees, how they feel about the fairness and the transparency we deliver to the organization, right? So
it's a great perspective because I think there's a lot in the media, of course, that it's an employer's market. It's an employee's market. It's very adversarial, right? And some leaders really buy into that. Well, now talent's getting tighter. We can be demand more of our people. What I love about what you're saying is thinking about our employees as customers. For our customers, we want a lifetime value of a customer. We want them to come back to us again and again. We want to make sure we're satisfying their needs. And it's a win-win relationship, right? And I think that's the right perspective to have when you think about the employee relationship. And you think about employee value propositions that way and talking about honoring the employee value proposition. Talk a little bit more about that because it's different, right? If you're Amazon, it's a different employee value proposition than if you're a small mid-market company with 300 people and it's more mom and pop, right?
Yeah. So there is a fundamental principle, which is you have a value proposition and then you deliver a value proposition. And I think the ideal is when you deliver on the promise. Now, that promise can be built in many different ways, right? So Amazon has an incredible brand and talent attraction power. Perhaps they can live without certain things. And some companies are less known, have a less prevalent brand in the market. They need to resort to other means. But the important thing is to be very clear about what are you offering as a marketing campaign and what are you delivering as a product. When Amazon tells you, I'm going to deliver this package to you in less than 12 hours, they do. And then you go back and shop and you pay for that extra shipping cost because you know you're going to get that. But if they give you this within the window, they promise 3 out of 5, you will not pay for that value. The same for employees. If I promise you I'm going to create employability value by the experiences and the learnings that you're going to have, I need to make sure of it. And I need to measure it. And I need to ask you how you feel about it. And I need to make sure that I'm delivering on my value proposition. Otherwise, it becomes very quickly into an empty value proposition and nobody really cares about that. Now, for instance, you talked about long-term value. I don't think this is about duration. It's about the quality of your experience while it lasts, like in any relationship. I can have a girlfriend for 10 years and be great or 6 months and be great. And the question is what we contributed to each other's lives, right? And the question is, when I was at Microsoft, I spent at Microsoft way less time than I would love to. I would love to be there for 10 years. I stayed too because I got in love with the idea of joining SOP. That is a company that I envision myself to be for a long time. But the thing is, I learned a lot in those 2 years from Satya, from a number of leaders there. The values at that company were amazing. People live those values. The company breathed certain air. You get a lot from your experience, right? And I think that what they deliver is very close to what they promise. It's not about time. It's about the intention of your value proposition, right? As I always say, every company has a value proposition. The question is it intentional? Is it controlled? Or is it a bit random?
That's a great question around employee value proposition. And I think the point you're bringing up at Microsoft is great. And for your experience, what an amazing company. And there are times now, I think the average tenure for someone in a role is less than 3 years. I think it might even be a little shorter than that. And some people believe, well, gosh, you were only there for 2 years. Did you make any impact? Well, of course you made impact in 2 years. We deliver quarterly results, right? So I don't believe that someone could be there for a short stint. I understand when someone's there for longer, but I do think there's a quality impact. You've got to ask about what did they do in that role? What kind of impact did they have? And can they talk about it, right? Some people might be there for 10 years and didn't deliver the same value that someone there for two. So it's a great point you're bringing up, Francisco.
How do you feel about that? By the way, JP, when you look at resumes today, 20 years ago, everyone in the resume had 5, 7, 10 years basis in companies, right? So you see more and more 2, 1.5, 3 years. And people say, well, this is a person that likes to change a lot. I think it's a phase in our workforce. I think people are more comfortable experimenting. The definition of failure is different as well. Before, if you didn't last for 10 years or 15 years in a company, something was wrong with you. Now, I think it's more transactional. I think this concept of loyalty has clearly less value, or I would say has no value in anybody's mind. It's not about loyalty. It's about what you gain. And it's okay to gain things, right? The company gains things from you. You gain things from the company. It's transactional. So if you don't feel like you're maximizing your ROI, you should move on. And if the company is not maximizing their ROI having you there, they should move you on. I think it's perfectly fine and no hard feelings, right? People, I think, nowadays understand that contractual nature more than before. Before, I remember when people in my role, unfortunately, I had to let go people, right? And it was very common to say, well, your phase here is over. And people would say, how is it possible? I gave all my life to this company. And people was passionately and personally and visibly invested in the company. Like it was the most important thing. Right now it's very different. And then it requires to think differently about this transactionality, no?
That's really, really insightful, Francisco. I think it's an important topic to people to think about. And I'm glad we brought this up and talked about it. The other piece that I want to get into, because you've got a phrase I think is going to be very popular after this episode, is this idea of zip code of value. And so you believe each functional role in a company has a zip code of value. So tell us more about this concept and what it means.
You asked me earlier about the difference between maybe transitioning from companies like IBM or Microsoft to companies like SoftBank or DigitalBridge. I think in smaller companies, because really it's not because these type of companies that are doing investments in particular, but I think smaller companies, what they have is a much clearer understanding on what's the value that every person brings to the organization, right? On a daily basis. In larger organizations with so many layers, they're so massive that they need to manage, right? They reach a scale that every person is incrementally adding on the whole product, let's say, adding to the bottom line in a very, very indirect way. But when you are in a smaller company, you realize that everyone has what I call a zip code, and all the zip codes are really defined by whatever nobody else is taking in a way, right? So first of all, it's quite fluid, the definition of what's your role. But then if you are not doing that, nobody else is doing it. So therefore, that is very good. But also that makes it very clear when someone lands in the organization without a clear role, which I call that they don't have a zip code or the letters on the packages don't get there, right? Because the UPS, FedEx, they don't know what to do with it, right? So basically, you are in an organization without a clear role, a clear mandate, in a universe of people that is small and everybody is very clearly aligned to a particular agenda, they have a particular deliverable, it becomes very polarizing. People like that don't last, right? So when I think about large organizations, I really think there's a huge opportunity in clarifying those zip codes or the definition of what is a value accretive role for the organization. I think we have a lot of people that they don't know what they do. And really for the sake of the organization, there's minimal line of sight to what is the contribution. And for me, it's one of the things I would struggle the most thinking about going back to a very large organization is like how I deal with all these people that really don't know exactly what is their role, right? What is their contribution? In organizations that are small, you see that more clearly. And I think in a way, the nature of the game is very different, but there's some principles that you have here that you could apply to any organization in terms of and the other thing is the clarity for every person you bring to the organization, there needs to be this clarity about what the person is here to do, right? Or the business. We are managing assets or we are raising fundraising or we are making investments, whether you contribute to any of those things or you don't have much to contribute. It's very clear for the person to deselect themselves from a firm like this. It's not so easy to deselect yourself from a company like Microsoft because it's way more indirect in terms of your connection to the bottom line.
Right. Yeah, it's not an A to B relationship in terms of value creation. But what I love about this concept, Francisco, is I think HR people, practitioners should think about this two ways. One, when we're hiring someone, making sure we're bringing someone in the organization, we know the zip code of value. Like, what are they coming in to do? What's the job to do? And what's the structure around that? Right? It may not be perfect, but you've got to get that more perfect than wrong.
Yeah.
And then second, as you think about your own career, what is your own zip code of value? Like, what are you great at? What do you want to be known for? Why are you contributing to the function? Or do people know that as well? Because taking the analogy of the package delivery, in large organizations, sometimes we know there's certain people that we can bring a certain package to, if you will, a piece of work, because they'll get it done and do better than anybody else. But if you're not delivering or building that brand and people don't know your zip code of value, then you may be more expendable, may not be having the career you're hoping for, right? So it's really clear to me that people need to think about that from two perspectives.
One of the benefits in working at a company like SoftBank, because now at DigitalBridge, the assets we manage are companies that are a bit more mature. At SoftBank, the companies are really early stage, growth stage. So you have a multitude of companies across all possible business segments where you have a bunch of hustlers, a bunch of people trying to work things out, and they are dealing with capital constraints, they're dealing with product issues, logistical issues, regulation issues, geographic expansions. So they're dealing with extremely concrete and fundamental and existential problems very early. And it's just them and the problem. And then I see executive assistants, analysts, anyone having an exponential learning in that environment. And they're exposed to so much, and they make so many mistakes, and they need to figure things out. They become professional hustlers. Now, it's a way to learn. I think in organizations like our bigger, you have a much more structured path to learning and development. But I think it would be great if we can all think about like a mix, a hybrid between these two experiences. So my advice to people nowadays is like, don't spend too much time before you get into an experience like an early stage or growth stage company, because you can learn so much and fast track your instincts and your tools and everything that you would like to develop. It exposes you to a level of stress that maybe is not something that is fun to do forever, but particularly when it's early in career, I think it's fascinating how much you learn. And suddenly I was talking to COOs that were like maybe 27-year-olds, and you would say, well, that person at IBM would be managing a team of 10 under four layers of management. This person now is making fundamental decisions that have P&L implications and product implications at this age, and it's exponentially more complex, right? I think it's really not so much what age we have, but what we have been exposed to, no? What makes us great professionals.
That's a really great perspective. And as you think about talent, because it's always retrospective, hindsight's 2020, right? We see these early stage founders, the Mark Zuckerbergs, et cetera, right? Who build these amazing companies like Facebook or Meta. And you're like, well, they're geniuses. Yes, they are smart. But to your point, they probably had a lot of good experiences. There's other people out there who are just as smart as some of these other founders. Maybe take Mark Zuckerberg off this, I don't know. But there's lots of young founders who at 27 became COOs or run a company. But it's really, they had the experience. They put themselves in the shoes. They learned as they went along. And they're on a different career path. They weren't a product manager at 27, working their way up that corporate ladder. They were building something. It's apples to oranges, right? They're not really the same. But you're saying, hey, do something, do go corporate first, get that experience, but then go high growth if you're that kind of person that wants to be pushed, challenged, and learn a ton.
Yeah. And man, to your point about the difference between is the same people, the same opportunities, I will use an analogy. I have to use a soccer analogy because I have to. If you think of Messi, which everyone, I can talk about maybe Tom Brady, I can talk about Steph Curry, I could talk about any athlete that you love and you think is amazing. They're maybe not smarter than everybody else, but the passion and the obsession they have about something is what makes them very different. And I say obsession in a good way, not obsession in the wrong way. It's irreplicable. Even if you try, it's almost like if I ask you to get taller, it's in your DNA, you cannot change it, right? So you can change your hair, you can be slimmer or chubbier, you can choose your physique, but you cannot choose to be taller or shorter. It's part of something you cannot change. For me, this passion, this obsession is what makes these founders possible and defines them, because they do things that normal people wouldn't do. I've witnessed that, and I am at awe with what they are willing to endure, the way they manage the negative feedback, the way they manage the challenges, the hurdles. Normal people, myself, I cannot do that, right? So, and I don't think I'm less smart than these people, but the relentless, the focus, the discipline they have for certain things is what makes. And we hear all day nowadays people talking about discipline, but I've seen it in action, and it's hard to do. It's very hard to do if you don't have it in you. Advice like that, it can go up to a certain point with normal human beings. And then there's the founders, you know what I mean? That right. Have a different scale of these things.
Well, you probably know this, but Jeff Bezos originally wanted to call Amazon Relentless.
Oh, he did.
This is from one of the books on that. You type in relentless.com, it actually takes you to Amazon. When I've been studying founders, what also is really interesting is they didn't always make it that first company. They may have started 10 companies and two became big. You know, that's the relentless part. They keep going. They're trying. They get the negative feedback. They shut it down, start another one. We like to see these stories of like the one-time founder, I got success right away. It's not true. It's not true in your career, right? It's not true in starting a business. You know, we think, oh, well, Francisco, what an amazing career you've had. Well, you've been working for this career for 20 years plus, right? no one's an overnight success. We always think about that. So just keep plugging away, be relentless.
That's for sure. One concept I want to leave with you, which is funny, I connected the dots between these things. I was reading a book about Michelangelo, and I remember reading something like the guy would look at a marble block and he would say, the statue is there. I just need to reveal it. It's not like I'm carving the stone. The statue is just, I see it. I just need to remove the parts that do not belong. And for me, a founder is exactly the same analogy. So the founder is there, and failure tras failure reveals that character and defines what type of founder. But you're a founder. You know you're a founder. You don't decide to become a founder. You are a founder when you're born with your DNA, selling lemonade, and then you don't want to go to college because you want to keep selling lemonade, right? Or you went to college with the obsession to develop a network just, and you don't stop thinking about your enterprise, the one that one day will be, right? And maybe it's not the second one, it's the first one, or the second one is the fourth one. But you always know what's your north, right? So for me, that's a bit the obsession I was talking about, which makes people very focused in their pursuits, right? And everything they do is about becoming that entrepreneur, even the failures.
It's so interesting because it's such a personality type, really, why they're entrepreneurs, and they luckily create a lot of value for us. I wanted to ask you more question about talent and how you assess talent, and walk us through what you look for when you're doing the interview process, whether that's an executive or early career, or there are certain things that you're looking for in trying to define and pick the right person for the role.
What I'm doing today clearly is not what I was doing 20 years ago. In a way, I'm exposed to different problems today, and maybe in my role, I have demands that I didn't have a few years ago. And also, I'm changing a bit my point of view on what is useful to really do in this thing. So talking about today, I think right now, for me, the most important thing is to understand what the person wants, to be honest with you. And I expect different level of self-awareness depending on who I'm talking to, right? So I'm talking to someone fresh out of college. Of course, my expectation is that person is trying to figure things out. And then I'm going to try to understand what type of character, what type of work ethic that person will bring to the team. Because I've seen people that really are smart, articulated, they have the voice, they have the poise, they have the ideas, but they're lazy. Or they just don't want to do that. They want to do something else. They're just trying to make somebody happy, but they're not happy doing that. So understanding the people's why they're doing this, and more importantly, why you want to do it here, right? And for me, that's the most important thing. And those answers are very revealing. And when I think of someone that is already senior, you know, number of years in their bag, and they're in an executive role, they need to bring a vision. So for me, what I try to do is typically insert myself in the latter part of the process, when they have had the opportunity to get exposure to a number of views, a number of stories about the role, the organization, the culture, everything. And I want to know whether they've done a good use of that time, how they actually extracted the fiber of the conversations, how much they understand the company, how much they have developed an excitement and a view, how they can contribute to the organization. And I want them to tell me the story. What you've learned, how you see, what you think you're going to be doing here, what are you going to help us do better? What's your vision about this? And I want them to have a point of view that sounds very informed. Because if you come to organizations, any organization, without knowing really why and what are you going to do, and you try to find out that starting day one, first, you've lost valuable time. And second, likely, we will not be able to do it. Because what I love is people that actually can deselect themselves from the job. So by the time I talk to these people, I already know they're very smart. They're very capable. They have experience. The question is this right for you? And only you know if that's true, right? So trying to extract that for me is the most important thing. And to be honest, the younger and the less experienced, the less clarity, of course, in terms of what they want to do. And we need to help them more, right? But I think at the latter part of their career, you should know.
Great, great advice, Francisco. All right, last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I would say opportunity is a word. And I'll tell you the phrase perhaps is a very common one, which is what got you here won't get you there. I like more the opportunity take on this because for me, it's not HR's fault that we haven't really done everything we could, because I think we are on a path of understanding how relevant we are in any given team, in any given organization, and the unique point of view we can bring to the table. I was talking to a number of CHROs from our portfolio companies, and they were like incredibly excited about it. They never thought about it, but It's like your point of view informs CEOs, informs the boards, informs investors, informs your colleagues in a way that no one else can, because the perspective you have is the perspective of an architect, an orchestra director, someone that cares about the functionality of the organization as a whole. So it's the closest to a CEO role that you can have in an organization, thinking about organizational effectiveness, right? But HR teams typically try to or lean towards process improvement, benefits, the important things, the plumbing, and things that if we don't do well, something suffers. But the opportunity for me is to understand the potential of the role, to understand how much you can fine-tune the organization, how much you can really change the organization in a way that is incredibly important. And sometimes by forcing decisions about upgrading talent, finding the right arguments and the right benchmarks and the right perspectives to help the organization progress towards a better version. The CEOs, the C-suite in general, they are filled with doubts. They're filled with fears. They're filled with egos, personal agendas. And you can be that objective person that becomes an ally to the team and the board. That is a role that is incredibly hard to play. But I'll tell you, if you are able to play it, it becomes such a transformational force. I remember when I was offered the role at DigitalBridge, we were debating around CHRO, Chief People Officer. I said, well, I would love the P to be about performance, not people, because at the end of the day, HR needs to be in charge and accountable of anything that leads to improve the performance of organization, right? So anything that you can do to make the boat go faster, that's the role we have, right? Because everybody else already has a job. The CMO has a job. The COO has a job. We have this job that is about making the boat go faster from an organizational perspective. So for me, that's the biggest opportunity. And I think organizations need that more than ever, because it's never been this complex before. I think we're facing exponential complexity, you know? And I think this is a moment that is perfect for us to reclaim, to reset. But you need the right people to do that, to be honest.
Thanks, Francisco. I love that you're encouraging us to think about and elevate the role that we play, because it's so critical to your point that HR leaders can have an impact on how CEOs think, how boards think, how the C-suite thinks from a much broader perspective, and that we should be the chief performance officer. So I love that. Thank you, Francisco, for being on the Future of HR podcast. It was a blast.
Thank you, JP, for having me. It's been great. Hope you invite me soon again.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Francisco for sharing his perspectives on the employee experience, working in early stage companies, and why CPOs need to embrace being chief performance officers. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe, share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Andy Storch. Andy is an author, coach, consultant, speaker, and facilitator on a mission to get the most out of life and inspire others to do the same. He's the author of the book, Own Your Career, Own Your Life. And he's also the host of three podcasts, including the Talent Development Hot Seat. And he co-founded and co-hosts the Talent Development Think Tank Conference and Community, as well as the host of the Talent Development Virtual Summit. Andy certainly is a busy guy, but in our conversation, we're going to discuss his career, his book, and his battle to overcome cancer. He's a true inspiration. I know you're going to really enjoy this conversation. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.